Everything from gas kitchens of tomorrow to self-contained old-fashioned outdoor lampposts, which turn on and off at the mere touch of a button with their own automatic lighting device. Or if you have a hard-to-heat room in your house, there's a winter heating unit which looks like a small air cooling unit, a window unit which draws its own combustion air from the outside and turns the spent gases to the outside too, but circulates and heats the air inside the room by force feed just as your air cooling unit cools it. A very aggressive industry bent on following up its advantage over electricity and those lines in which it excels, several new gas refrigerator makes, ice makers, industrial equipment of various sorts, and a lot of vigorous young men with imagination and drive. One other item, brand new, is a smokeless, odorless gas incinerator for the home, which not only disposes of your garbage, but your trash as well, turns bushels of both into a mere cupful of ashes while you're tending your regular chores. Very interesting indeed, a wonderful show, and a worthy example of an aggressive industry and the contribution it is making, and this is the important thing, to the national economic recovery that happily seems to be in the making. In Rome, the earthly remains of Pope Pius XII were laid traditionally today in a crypt near the remains of the Apostle St. Peter, founder of the Church of Rome and its first pope, to lie there for a period of 1 year, then to be moved to his own crypt to join the company of the popes between. But today's ceremonies, while colorful in the extreme, were not for the eyes of laymen. Only the functionaries of the church were permitted to be present, although television cameras, for the first time in history, beamed parts of the ceremonies of today to the outside world. President Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles will pay this nation's respects to the late Pope Pius tomorrow morning when they attend a requiem mass in St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington. Mr. Dulles explained to newsmen that his usual Tuesday morning news conference will have to be delayed until later in the day because of that occasion. I'll have more news for you now in just half a minute.
What's the best fuel for my new car?
For my 59 Buick.
For my fine young Dodge.
59 Mobile Gas Special.
For my 57 Chevy.
For my brand new Ford. For my 58 Plymouth.
For any young car.
59 Mobile Gas Special.
Why?
It's the powerful new fuel for powerful young cars.
Over 100 octane, of course.
The Supreme Court, back in regular session for its normal fall-winter-spring term. Its previous work this fall has been in special emergency session, considering the integration-segregation problems that required immediate attention, handed down one important and encouraging decision today, refusing to hear an appeal by John William Powell and his wife Sylvia and an associate Julian Schumann in the famous case, or infamous we might say, of the China Monthly Review, published by the three in Shanghai during the Korean War and charged in an indictment with printing seditious articles about the United States Armed Forces. This is a bizarre and in some ways almost incredible case, the attorney for the defendants being a Californian named A.L. Wirin, who has seemed to specialize in clients of this kind for a considerable period. He was the attorney for the California professor Linus Pauling and Britisher Bertrand Russell and socialist Norman Thomas and a group of international scientists, politicians, and churchmen last April when they asked a federal court injunction against Secretary of Defense Neil McElroy and the five members of the Atomic Energy Commission to prevent them from conducting any more atomic tests. This was in perfect timing and propaganda coordination with the communist line from Moscow, which was promoting the same idea at that stage, but the request for the injunction was turned down. In the Powell case, the three defendants were indicted by a federal jury in California, federal grand jury, on the grounds that they made in their publication various untrue charges about the United States that gave aid and comfort to the enemy, being accusation that the United States did use germ warfare against the communists in North Korea and that it was guilty of aggression. Attorney Wirin appeared in court and demanded on behalf of the defendants that he be permitted to visit Red China as an officer of the court to interview witnesses and collect evidence to be used in their defense. The presiding judge in the case, Judge Louis Goodman, not only agreed to this, but stated that unless the State Department granted the necessary permission, visas, and passports to Attorney Wirin within 30 days, he would dismiss the indictment against all three defendants. The State Department was very defensive, very reluctant about that idea because of the possible implications with the communist Chinese government, but at the urging of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, decided to grant the permission, with the result that Attorney A.L. Wirin spent some 7 weeks touring Red China on an American passport, the first individual ever to do so. Incidentally, the court ordered that during the trip, the Justice Department must pay all transportation costs to and from the Red China mainland, $12 a day living expenses, and 7 cents a mile for all travel inside Red China, all out of your taxes, you will be pleased to know. Upon returning to the United States, complete with new bushy beard, Attorney Wirin told Judge Goodman's court that he had found hosts of evidence and to support the defense of his clients and many witnesses who would testify for them, but that in order for that testimony to be recognized and honored in American courts of law, it would be necessary for the United States to negotiate a so-called judicial agreement with the Chinese Communist government, which was the final straw so far as the State Department was concerned. Number one, this would have had the effect of recognizing the Chinese Communist judicial system as being on a moral and legal par with our own. Second, it would have been a foot in the door for Red China toward recognition of the Communist government by this country. Attorney Wirin took the case to the Supreme Court asking for a hearing on the matter of forcing negotiations for the judicial agreement, and that is the point on which the court ruled today. It refused to grant the hearing, thereby sending the case back to Judge Goodman, and the trial in Judge Goodman's federal court in San Francisco now goes on. A weird story, particularly in that the China Monthly Review was once one of the most respected English-language publications in the Far East, owned and edited by young Powell's father, who lost both of his feet in a Chinese prison camp and finally died as a result. The son and daughter-in-law inherited the publication, turned it into this. Along with the germ warfare charges, they also charged that the United States deliberately dragged its feet in the truce negotiations with North Korea in order to prolong the fighting there. Incidentally, speaking of the Supreme Court, the interim appointee Potter Stewart takes his place on the bench tomorrow, and Chief Justice Earl Warren took time today to deliver a farewell tribute to Mr. Justice Burton, who is retiring for reasons of health. He expressed the personal good wishes of the members of the bench and praised the service that Mr. Justice Burton has performed. The Communist Chinese have volunteered to extend the ceasefire against Quemoy Island for an additional 2 weeks to the jubilation of the nationalist government leaders on Formosa, who claim that it is a confession that the Communists were unable to break the island's defenses and an admission of defeat. That may be a little over-optimistic, and perhaps it would be better to wait until the end of this extra fortnight to see what the Communists do then. But it is an established fact that the nationalist defenses on the island are actually stronger at the end of the bombardment ordeal than they were when the pounding started, and the Communists on the mainland never even got within trying distance of a launching effort. That was a lot of ammunition that was lobbed over from the mainland, and ammunition costs money, and after it has cost the money, it costs time and patience to get it to the scene of operations, because the city of Amoy, from which the Quemoy bombardment is taking place, is one of the most inaccessible points in all of China except by water. That is the way the city was built originally, by its waterborne commerce, and there has never been any serious thought of supplying it by rail. But the communist invasion plans have suffered two very disastrous setbacks. As long as Quemoy is in the hands of the nationalists, Amoy on the mainland is completely cut off from all waterborne commerce, supplies, even by the smallest cargo ships. But even worse than that, the air-to-air Sidewinder missiles that the Nationalist Air Force has been using with such devastating results have completely grounded the Communist Air Force, and without air support, any attempt to actually invade Quemoy Island is not only impossible but unthinkable and suicidal. Maybe this stall for time by the Communists is to try to find some defense against the missiles, but that's going to take a lot longer than 2 weeks, and it's going to take a lot more than 2 weeks also to resupply the ammunition that was squandered to no useful purpose whatsoever in the past weeks of bombardment. So regardless of what ultimately turns up as the future plan of communication, of communist action, this much certainly can be said. The communists have won absolutely nothing thus far in Quemoy, and the Red leaders have lost a considerable amount of face with the people of the Far East generally. I'll have more news for you now in just 1 minute.
A familiar sight is the American schoolhouse, and seeing one almost always calls up memories of childhood, because for most of us, schools and childhood are inseparable. But there are kids that will never get to a school like that. They are the kids with cerebral palsy. And there are more than 200,000 of them. Somewhere in America, cerebral palsy strikes some child every 53 minutes, every day in the year. And when it does, in all probability, that little kid, boy or girl, won't ever attend our kind of school. That little kid's school will be a United Cerebral Palsy Treatment Center. His teachers will be different than the others the kids have. His teachers will be physical therapists, occupational therapists, clinic attendants, nurses, doctors. These kids will learn to live. They'll learn the hard way because almost every movement they make takes a hard, teeth-gritting effort of the will. United Cerebral Palsy is dedicated to serving these more than 200,000 children and all others with cerebral palsy.
Senators, both up for re-election 3 weeks from tomorrow, called on President Eisenhower today, said they believe they're going to win, but they'd feel much better about it if he would pay a personal visit to West Virginia and lend them his own individual support. One is Senior Senator Chapman Revercomb, serving his second term now, trying for third. The other is Junior Senator John Hoblitzel, Jr., appointed to fill the vacancy left by the death of the late Senator Matt Neely and now required to run for the remainder of the Neely term. That's the top of the news as it looks from here.